Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host, Saquon Gatlin. This is my first time hosting Local Talk as a summer intern for KHOI, and I am very excited to service the Ames community. This week and next week, Local Talk will air Candidates with Cal, a series where Cal Halliburton speaks with candidates for governor. Cal recently had a conversation with Governor Hopeful, John Norris.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Mr. John Norris. Mr. Norris is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. John is a fifth-generation Iowan, raised on the Montgomery County family farm that his great-great-grandparents settled in 1881. Educated at Red Oak Community Schools, Simpson College, and the University of Iowa College of Law. After graduating from college, John worked for Tom Harkin and then became the state director of the Iowa Farm Unity Coalition, while also owning and operating the Old Hotel restaurant in Greenfield. Leonard Boswell hired John to run his first campaign for Congress and serve as his first chief of staff in Congress. John then chaired the Iowa Democratic Party during Governor Vilsack's first term and was then appointed as governor's chief of staff. John coordinated the hiring of Vilsack's first cabinet and staff and helped balance the state's budget. He chaired the governor's Electric Restructuring Committee, writing legislation that resulted in Iowa's wind energy industry. Vilsack later appointed John to chair the Iowa Utilities Board, and the U.S. Secretary Vilsack appointed him chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. John was appointed by President Obama to serve as a commissioner on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and later appointed him to represent the United States on agricultural policy at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and World Food Program in Rome, Italy. After returning to Iowa, John is co-owner of the State Public Policy Group, where he works on issues that make a positive difference for the people of Iowa. He and his wife Jackie live in Des Moines with their three sons. The Norris family volunteers with their Boy Scout troop and are active in the Plymouth United Church of Christ. John, would you tell our listeners something about yourself that we won't find on your website and we won't find it with a search engine?
My family's quite musical. I grew up playing in the Norris Family Band down in southwest Iowa, and we played senior centers and county fairs, and I still try and get the guitar out once in a while. I'm actually going to be playing a little bit this weekend in Waterloo, so looking forward to that. I guess music and being involved with my kids is really what I'm most proud of.
As you talk with people across the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
Well, far and away, the most dominant issue I've run into on this campaign, whether I'm with a group of two or 200, it's the failure of our mental health system. It clearly is impacting every community and nearly every family, and we just have to address the lack of mental health services in Iowa.
Let's assume you're elected. If that's a top priority for you, what specifically can you do about it?
I think there's a number of things. Now, it's complicated by the privatization of Medicaid. About 70% of our mental health patients are on Medicaid. So by privatizing Medicaid, we have made it even more difficult for them to get services. And we're literally driving mental health providers from Iowa because of the bureaucracy and denial of payments and the low payments mental health providers are receiving from Medicaid. So we've got to first reverse the privatization of Medicaid, make it focused on providing health services, not focused on profits for insurance companies. Then we've got to look at our regional health system. We have 14 mental health regions in the state of Iowa. And we have to set an expectation for each one of those regions from a continuum of care, from acute care beds to outpatient and community-based services that each region will be expected to provide. And then we empower those regions to do it in the most efficient way possible. But we've got to levelize our property tax rate freeze because each county is frozen at their 1996 level. So you have disparity between the counties, which causes lack of cooperation within those regions. We've got to levelize that. Long term, I think we have to get away from a property tax-funded mental health system and have a designated revenue stream from our general fund to support mental health across the state. And finally, that regional system is just for adults. We have no children's mental health system in the state of Iowa. And that is particularly concerning because we're losing so many of our youth who have mental health challenges, and we're not getting them the appropriate help they need to become productive citizens.
Well, as a former teacher, is there a role that the education system can help play?
Well, you certainly hear it from teachers and school administrators about the problems created by not having a children's mental health system. Mm-hmm. So we need to partner with our schools, provide in-school assistance through counselors and mental health providers, make sure children are getting the help they need. Mm-hmm. But it's even more compounded within our schools because today nearly half of the children born in Iowa are born eligible for Medicaid. That's a shocking statistic. Born into poverty. Free and reduced lunch has doubled in the last 15 years. So we have to focus on breaking that cycle of poverty. We know that one in five children will have a mental health need. It's even more profound amongst those children coming from stressful economic home environments. This lack of children's mental health system is really compounding our ability to help those children be successful and break that cycle of poverty. I'm really focused on getting people out of poverty in this state.
Rural communities all across the state are struggling.
No, absolutely. I think people in Ames and Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City all recognize if the roads all around our growth corridors, that we can't afford to sustain the human and physical infrastructure of this entire state. So it's really important for all of Iowa that we rebuild the economy in rural Iowa. It starts with good schools and good hospitals. The underfunding of education and the privatization of Medicaid are making that more challenging. Stripping away collective bargaining rights for teachers is going to make it harder to attract good teachers in our rural schools. So we've got to fix those two fundamental building blocks of rural communities. And then there's a menu of things we can be doing. There's no silver bullet. We have to make sure that broadband is accessible everywhere in Iowa. That's really the FDR's rural electrification of our time. We know it's essential for the economy, and we have to get broadband out into those rural areas. I propose that we leverage the Iowa Communication Network, which we built 30 years ago in this state. We have fiber optic cable going to every county, but it's restricted to use for public use for the schools and National Guard and our county governments and hospitals. I want to open that up because 90% of that fiber optic cable is not even lit up or utilized, so that nonprofits and for-profits in those rural communities can bid to get access to that line. And whoever provides the most service to the most amount of customers in those rural areas for the least cost gets access. Mm-hmm. Renewable energy. Wind energy and the ethanol energy and the solar energy business in Iowa have potential to grow, especially the solar industry. And we need to make sure that we are incenting those jobs and that development to occur because that's jobs in rural Iowa. And I also believe that focusing on the new interest in younger farmers wanting to get into sustainable and diversified agriculture, that's going to be our growth area on the farm sector side in rural Iowa. So we need to design our beginning farmer programs around helping those new diversified sustainable operations get off the ground and help them with markets and processing so we create economies of scale that they can get started and ramp up economically quicker to get off the ground. Those are a few examples. I'd say one more thing. The build-out in the wind industry in Iowa and the wind farms, that's a whole new source of property tax revenue for a third of our state geographically, about 35 counties. I want to empower those counties to utilize that new property tax revenue from the wind farms to enhance quality of life in rural communities, from culture and arts to world-class schools to regional transit for our older citizens. And that's – we have to seize the opportunity from that new source of revenue from our wind farms so that all Iowans in those rural communities can benefit from the increased revenue. I think I approached it more from like during the Vilsack administration, we did the Vision Iowa program. Mm-hmm. And that restored a lot of historic buildings. It rejuvenated rural communities by leveraging public and private investment. What I would like to do for each one of those counties who have a wind farm to have them go through a visioning exercise, knowing how much revenue they're going to get from those wind farms and property tax revenues, and vision how that will change the quality of life in their county. What needs do they have? What opportunities can they see? And then leverage that new property tax revenue source for investment and leveraging private investment as well to create new opportunities in our rural communities.
Mm-hmm. What do we have? 8,000 ponds of poo all over the state of Iowa. And, you know, we use some of it on by applying it on the land, but there's a lot of runoff. It gets into rivers and streams and eventually into aquifers.
No, this is a problem we have to address. The misapplication of animal waste from our confined feeding operations that's now, as you say, getting into our underground aquifers, E. coli showing up in our lakes and rivers and streams. And that's, I think, detrimental to our future. And so I think we have to make the producers responsible, though, for the handling of that waste. And I've called for a moratorium on those animal confining feeding operations until we have real enforceable environmental standards in place. We raised last year in Iowa about 23 million hogs. That's the equivalent of the waste of about 130 million human beings. That's a lot of waste to deal with. I think until we get environmental standards in place, we have to halt further expansion and really assess what is our capacity. What is the capacity of the land to absorb if it's applied appropriately? I'm concerned that we're going to become a big waste pool of hog poop if we don't get our arms around this. It's also fractured our sense of community. Well, I think of that when our values, community values and caring for each other is so fundamental. Mm-hmm. This is really driving wedges between rural communities because of the inability of someone to protect their value of their land and their quality of life from when a confinement operation goes in next door. Mm-hmm. And that's causing a lot of strife that we have to be mindful of if we're going to really stay true to those values.
You know, one of the things that comes up in discussions is all the outside money pouring into the political system here in Iowa. Is there a way that we can, in Iowa, put some restrictions on that that make a difference and really reduce that?
It is the elephant in the room of our democracy and our politics. We really have a state today that's run by special interests and corporate lobbyists for the benefit of the wealthy, and that has to change. We have no campaign contribution limits in Iowa. I find that disgraceful. Mm-hmm. It's just an open door for the wealthy special interest to control our elections. Before I got in this race, as I was contemplating entering the race for governor, I challenged my Democratic opponents to at least adopt the federal campaign finance limits for this gubernatorial primary. No one took me up on it except Jonathan Niederbach, and he dropped out of the race. But we have to curtail the special interest money. And long term, I believe we have to go to a public financing system for campaigns so we level the playing field. So it really comes down to who's the best candidate and who has the best policies and proposals that can get folks behind their agenda, not the agenda of the special interest.
Along that line, of course, tied to all the money that gets into politics is the state budget. And, of course, we build the state budget with taxes. What are we going to do to get a budget that's going to be a reasonable size so that we can make reasonable investments in things like education?
This is another example of the influence of corporate lobbyists. 30 years ago, we used to talk about people cheating or corporations cheating on their taxes. Now they don't have to cheat anymore. They just hire good lobbyists and get laws passed that get some tax breaks. Mm-hmm. And so we've eroded hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue in just the last 5 years in Iowa through special tax credits and deductions and giveaways that have eroded our capacity to invest in education, public education, mental health services, cleaning up our environment.
In order to tax folks, they need to make money.
Government is, in some respects, different than business, but in some respects, like business. Mm-hmm. Revenue matters. Revenue matters for business. Mm-hmm. Revenue matters for government. All governments, I think, should be extremely responsible and cognizant of managing taxpayers' money effectively and that it's spent efficiently. But you have to have sufficient revenues if you're going to have a strong public education system, mm-hmm. if you're going to have mental health services, if we're going to invest in worker training. So many of these businesses I talk to across Iowa, their biggest challenge is finding workers. They literally are turning down orders because they can't find the workforce. And they're here paying taxes. But our economic development strategy is to lure out-of-state businesses here with tax cuts, which undermines our capacity to invest in education for our workforce, for those businesses who are here and want to grow. And we need them to grow for our economy to continue. But we're not building the capacity to do that because of this special giveaways to lure out-of-state businesses here. I think we should focus on investing in Iowa businesses and our Iowa workforce.
It's been our pleasure talking with John Norris, John is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor. Thank you very much, John.
Great to be with you.
And listeners, thank you for tuning in.
If you have just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been hearing from John Norris speaking with Cal Halliburton about his candidacy for governor as a Democrat in the upcoming June 5th primary. I'm your host, Saquon Gatlin, a recent graduate from Iowa State. This past semester, I was a member of the East African dance team where I met two women of Ethiopian origin. Theirs is an interesting story. Ramate Bunga and Eden Gebre have experienced the joys and challenges of being people of two cultures. The two sat down to speak with me about what that's like, especially since their home, Ethiopia, has a unique history for the continent of Africa.
Ethiopia is a very different country compared to other African countries in a way, because Ethiopia didn't experience colonization because it was a foreign state.
Wow, interesting.
Because mostly the Italians tried to occupy Ethiopia, but then they weren't able to because Ethiopia defeated them. But it's one of those sovereign states. It's one of the only African countries that was never colonized. So that made more other African countries to become independent from the colonization and stuff like that. So coming from that, Ethiopia was able to attain most of their culture and language and everything. That had a big impact, I would say.
Yeah. Wow. Could you go into a little bit more of that story? That's something that I'm pretty sure most of our viewers
have not heard. With that comes a lot of the times not being colonized. Being Ethiopian, it's very different from being African American here, because we may not understand racism as much as African Americans here. I mean, people do understand what's going on, mm-hmm. but we may not see it right away because we haven't experienced racism or colonization our whole life. So, even though we're grouped as Africans, or some of them that grew up here are considered African Americans, but still, that part of us we do understand what's going on, but we may not see it right away. Or even those little microaggressions or something like that. I'm sometimes guilty of that too, because those kind of things happen. I know what kind of racism or things that go on, but just because I was raised in Ethiopia and have never experienced racism in my life, it's more of hard for me to see what's actually going on in this world. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you see the news all the time, but when it happens to you, I may not be able to see it right away. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because of where you were raised in and the history of your country.
Country, yes.
So a lot of times, what I've learned being around, my Nigerian friends, my Liberian friends, my Ethiopian friends, Sudanese people, I see so many differences in the cultures. However, that is not the portrayal that most media gives us. They kind of group everyone from Africa in as Africans. Can you explain some of the differences between your culture and trying to define it differently compared to what is this picture of Africa or this picture of African?
A lot of people have common misconception when it comes to culture within Africa. Africa in general has a rich and beautiful culture that people don't get to see. Even in Ethiopia, there is so many different cultures within Ethiopia. Me and her, we're Ethiopian, but we come from specifically different tribe. So within my tribe, there is different villages that has different culture, different dialect, different things that they do. Even my own, within my ethnic, there's 8 different types of culture, and I come from one. And that one has its own thing, its own beauty, its own outfit, its own food, its own hair type. I can't even tell you how amazing it is. But when we talk overall, we do have one that actually represents everybody, which mm-hmm. is the clothing. We call it Habesha Kamis. and that has like it's a plain white, and then you can do your tribal print on it, and you know which tribe you actually come from within that.
So this is like a dress, and it has
like
print that goes down the middle.
Yes, in the middle, or you can just design it however you feel like it.
Okay.
And that you could put your actual tribal print on it, and then you could tell like you're from Ethiopia from just the material itself.
Wow.
Which is it's amazing.
That's very interesting. Your interactions with specifically Americans, how has that influenced the way that you have gotten around college or so? Well, this is your first year here, so how has that influenced your college experience, the interactions with just regular Americans?
Since I grew up here, like, the whole ESL, like, English second language classes, I went through those, like, around elementary and first grade, second grade time. So I went back to Ethiopia for a little bit, and I came back towards the end of my middle school year. So most of the people that I went to school came out here, so it was kind of an easy transition for me. However, I resonate more towards with the Ethiopian culture, so in a way, I feel a little bit too cultured around them because of my Ethiopian values or just the way I see life or the way I see things doesn't necessarily match up to what the way they act or the way that they see things. That was kind of difficult for me. And then, like, if I go back to, like, the Ethiopian community, they kind of, like, I feel a little bit too Americanized because I'm very open-minded, and in Ethiopia, like she said, certain things are very strict. There are certain things, like, they don't allow you to express yourself. It can be, for example, like, expressing your sexuality is a big thing. It's a little hush-hush. It's more like express it to yourself than the community.
So you're kind of not supposed to really speak about it?
Yeah. They don't even talk about sex, like, education when it comes to, like, sex or anything like that. So that's, like, really big thing. I think, yeah, for me, I really didn't have a hard time transitioning like that. It's just, like, little things. Feeling like I might be maybe a little bit too cultured for certain people type of thing, but mainly I was able to figure out, like, being here longer helps.
Okay. So you feel, just to clarify or maybe make sure that I'm on the same page with you, you feel that sometimes you may be too cultured for Americans, but if you go home, then you may be too Americanized. For, or like have like a Eurocentric set of thinking or so for your family.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. How has that dynamic changed you and your family?
The good thing is, like, my family's, they're very adapting. They're big on, like, you do you, figure out, like, what's best for you and what works for you better. Like, we came here for a better life for you. If expressing certain things helps you, go ahead. Okay. With my family, that's not really the issue. But when it comes to the whole entire community, like, for certain people, yeah, okay, it's absolutely okay. Especially the ones that have been here longer. But the ones that are, like, newcomers, that are, like, a little bit older, it's kind of, like, difficult to get through or to, like, actually express yourself and tell them how you actually feel about just the world in general. And it goes back to, like, oh, we're Ethiopians, we don't do that. Like, they say a lot of stuff like that. Even, like, when it comes to clothing, it's more like, you're a lady, and, like, a little...
Like, you need to dress a specific way.
Yeah, correct.
And that's why I was asking if you could explain a little bit more, like, specifically even the clothing. Like, what is considered more traditional clothing, and is it, like, more revealing, the clothing that you have now, or how does that work?
Very less revealing things are very common there. Since a lot of people are really traditional, they cover up, not in a sense of, like, they do the whole, like, head covering, but just cover up body parts where people think it's a little bit more provocative.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And for you, can you explain how, like, your interactions with Americans has changed your sense of community?
For me, like she said, she's been here longer than me. So, like, I mean, communicating with Americans wasn't that hard, but, like, there's certain words, like, for example, like, types of food, like, vegetables and stuff like that. I think of it in Amharic, and sometimes I don't think of the word in English. And so, like, it's more of, like, I think both in Amharic. I think in Amharic. It's more of, like, I have been used to that. So coming here, it's, like, I want to say it, but, like, and then it doesn't come up quickly. So, like, sometimes those little things are harder, like, for me to communicate with Americans. But besides that, it's been good so far. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So you have a dual brain going on there.
Yes.
Where you're like always divided between the two. Can you describe the impact of the African community here on your experience and your time?
I became part of African Student Association like very recently. The first meeting I went to, I remember I kind of felt a sense of home in a way, like even though Africa has every African country is very different in their own way, but at the same time, we have a common ground, something that we share. Being able to go to those meetings and interacting with people from different parts of Africa made me feel like home in a way, like mm-hmm. I felt a sense of home.
For me, when I go there, like, I feel like I'm at home. The fact that, like, Africa brings everybody together, and then beyond that, like, I try to get people that don't know anything about African culture to get to know. Like, for example, when we do practices or dances for African Night, I try to get people that are not Ethiopians to come join us to learn about our culture. That way, you know, that way we can leave some sort of impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, we tell them about, like, how we are as a person and some of the things that we value. If, like, for us, like, weddings, graduations, funerals, they're big. So whenever, like, I'm interacting with people and we talk about culture, we talk about life, and I'm like, hey, like, as Ethiopian, we do this and that. And they mm-hmm. they get fascinated and they want to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know what? Like, if we do this, like, I'm going to teach you more. And I try to do that. I try to leave some sort of impact by maybe through dances or through just telling them, like, some of the things that we value as Ethiopians, or even, like, being American and just, like, living, being Ethiopian and living in America, how, like, those two things has helped me become the person I am.
Mm-hmm. Why do you believe that is important, being an ambassador for your community in that way? Because that's what you're basically doing if you are trying to get people to come to the dance and, or at least that are not Ethiopian, like how you did with me. If you were trying to get people who are not from this culture to understand your culture, why is that important to you?
I think people have, like, a bad misconception of, like, what African countries are or African cultures are in general. So therefore, like, I feel in a way obligated, not necessarily, but in a way obligated to teach them, hey, like, it's really not the picture that's painted. There is more to that. So I feel like it's important for people to get to know things that they don't know. Education, learning is the key to not just have that bad misconception, but actually get to know the culture through somebody that has been through it, that have seen it.
Bessom back at Dassay, Yare Dawizema. Yenna ነጻነት ፍጥሮ አንደሳ እንደሽማ በጨዋነት ባህል አሳድገሽኛል በኢትዮጵያዊነቴ እንድኮራ አድርጎኛል ባይለው ነው እንጂ የህል ውሃ ነገር ከእናት ጓዳ ርቆ ማኔ ወጣ ነበር አንድ ላይ ነው ሳቅና ደስታው ከመአዱ ቆርሶ የሚበላው ዝናሽ ይታይ ባለም ይሰማው ከፍ ብለሽ በክብር አርማ ቀን ቢከፋ ባይደለሽ ዛሬ ይመለሳል ክብረሽ ሀገሬ 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 ሀገሬ
That was Ethiopian musician Jackie Gosi. We just finished listening to two Iowa State students speaking on the uniqueness of their home country, Ethiopia. If you enjoyed the story, the full version will be aired next Friday at 1 p.m. on KHOI. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio with Saquon Gatlin. Thanks for listening. It's Friday. Here's Dennis Hart with the roundup of last week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. Dennis?
Let's start with Tuesday's Ames Tribune, which reported that authorities looking into that weekend fire that damaged the restroom building at Brookside Park in Ames closed the investigation on Monday. But the cause of the blaze could remain a mystery, because investigators were not able to determine what ignited it. The only way the investigation would reopen is if new information about the fire came forward. The blaze began on the east side of the building's awning near the center pillar, either in or close to a nearby trash can. Firefighters responded to the blaze early Saturday morning. It caused about $50,000 damage. Portable toilets were dropped off at Brookside for public use as the city's Parks and Recreation Department started coming up with a plan to bring bathrooms back to the park. Tuesday's Trib also reported that the man killed in a house fire in Jewell last week was identified as 73-year-old Gary Carlson. Firefighters went to 3685 Poplar Grove Avenue on April 30th. They found a property completely engulfed in flames. Carlson ran a salvage business, and the home was surrounded by old cars, a liquid propane tank, inflated tires, and other materials that caused explosions. Winds up to 25 miles an hour quickly spread the flames to a nearby garage and to an abandoned farmhouse on the property. Between 35 and 40 firefighters from Jewell, Story City, Stanhope, and Ellsworth worked to put out the blaze. Authorities said it does not appear to be suspicious. Also in Tuesday's Trib, word that applications are being sought for anyone interested in holding a seat on the Ames School Board to replace Rodney Briggs. Briggs resigned in order to relocate to the Des Moines metro area, a move that made him ineligible to continue on the board. He had served since 2011. Board members decided Monday night to open up applications to the public. The board has until June 1st to fill Briggs' seat. Applications for the position will be taken until next Thursday, and materials will be made available on the school district's website and at its business office. On May 21st, a forum will be held before the scheduled board meeting to evaluate people interested in filling the vacancy. The goal is to fill Briggs' position on May 21st, unless the public calls for a special election for the seat. The public has 14 days starting this past Tuesday to collect the roughly 1,200 signatures on a petition to ask the board to hold a special election on July 10th. That election would cost about $15,000 from the district's general fund during the next budget year. However a new school board member is chosen, he or she would serve the rest of Briggs' term, which runs until November 2019. There was more in Tuesday's Trib, including word that employees of the Ames Gamer Store said they were unfairly portrayed by the company after it shut down all its Iowa stores over the weekend. The Nebraska-based video game chain said it would close its stores in Ames at 302 Lincoln Way and in the Des Moines metro area. It blamed declining sales, police holds on allegedly stolen items, and various break-ins and robberies. The company also said the closures were partially because of issues with staff members and their behavior, saying there were reports of employees spraying each other with window cleaner, turning away trade-in items, browsing online during work, and using racial slurs, along with being rude to customers. The former general manager of the Ames location, Justin Zimmerman, said the company told workers it was planning to remodel the stores about 2 weeks ago. He and his staff were asked to pack up the store and sell fixtures to pay for renovations. Then he said he received a text message from the company's general manager that the stores were closed effective immediately. Zimmerman said he heard from customers that there were a few issues with employees in years past, but he never saw the behavior the company described in its memo. Tuesday's Tribune also had word that the hunt for suspects in last month's bank robbery in Maxwell was ongoing. Two men entered the bank on Main Street in Maxwell on April 10th. They displayed handguns and ordered employees to get on the floor. They took an undisclosed amount of money and fled in a vehicle. That vehicle was found a short time later unoccupied just south of Maxwell City Park. No injuries were reported in the incident. Anyone with information that could help locate the suspects is urged to contact the Story County Sheriff's Office. In Wednesday's Tribune, a report on Tuesday night's Ames City Council meeting, where the council passed the second reading of a proposed rental cap ordinance. But there are clear indications that final approval of the 25% rental restriction might come later than expected. After council members Amber Corrieri and Chris Nelson voiced concerns about the cap's unintended consequences and about areas where the restrictions might be implemented, the council established an order of discussion for its next meeting to perhaps reach a consensus. Corrieri and Nelson voted no on the second reading of the ordinance, which would prohibit any new property in some city neighborhoods from registering as a rental if at least 25% of the properties in the neighborhood are already rentals or if the new property would push the neighborhood beyond the 25% threshold. Current rentals would be able to continue operating. Right now, the council plans to install the cap on six neighborhoods near Iowa State University. Tuesday night, the council voted to take up several related discussions before the third reading of the ordinance. Among them, whether to extend the city's moratorium on issuing new rental permits in eight neighborhoods near the campus, and how the city would handle so-called hardship properties, ones that the rental cap could negatively affect by keeping them from being sold. The council also will talk again about which parts of the city it wants the rental cap to apply to. Councilman Tim Garten said, in his words, "We're trying to reach a consensus, and maybe we can compromise." At Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting, the supervisors unanimously approved revised remodeling plans for the county animal shelter. This after estimated cost for shelter improvements back in December came in at nearly $700,000. At that time, supervisors asked for revisions to make the renovations more affordable. Those revisions came back to the board in February, reducing the cost to $368,000. The board should be getting bids for the reduced renovation plans in a month or so. Also Wednesday in the Trib, word that a lawsuit filed by a former Iowa State University student that alleged Title IX violations and mishandling on the part of the university from a 2015 sexual assault was settled for $47,500 this week. Last summer, a complaint was filed against Iowa State, among other defendants, that alleged the student was sexually assaulted by a member of a fraternity at a Greek residence. The complaint alleged that the defendants failed to comply with their duties under Title IX and did not stop members of the university's Greek community from harassing and retaliating against the student after she reported being sexually assaulted. The Iowa State Appeal Board approved the settlement this week, with $15,000 going to the former student and $32,500 going for attorney's fees. In a prepared statement, a university spokesperson said the settlement allows both the university and the student to move forward in a more positive way. Wednesday's Trib also reported that the Ames School Board has approved the district's 2018-2019 general fund budget, one that provides funding for a new assistant elementary principal position and preserves the role of the middle school's student advocate and the district's associate superintendent. Still on the school beat, the Tribune reported that Ballard High School students organized a school-wide walkout Tuesday, which coincided with National Teacher Appreciation Day. The walkout took place during the time normally allotted for their advisor period. About 80 students took part. On the crime beat, the Tribune reported that a Nevada man was arrested Tuesday after court documents alleged he stole a vehicle in Des Moines and drove it to Ames. 19-year-old Tyler Aaron Lee Kaufman was charged with second-degree theft and with operating a vehicle without the owner's consent. This after an Ames police officer stopped the Jeep that Kaufman was in early Tuesday morning at 9th and Grand Avenue because it was operating without headlights. Thursday's Tribune reported that the Ames City Council has approved the first reading of an ordinance that would establish new zoning standards for businesses along Lincoln Way south of downtown. If that ordinance eventually passes, it would establish new standards for business uses, structures, and site improvements. The businesses that do not adhere currently to those standards would be labeled as nonconforming, but would still be allowed to operate. New nonconforming businesses would be banned from opening within the borders of the new zoning district. Gas stations, car washes, repair shops, and warehouse businesses would be rendered nonconforming under the ordinance. The measure would also restrict the number of drive-through businesses in the area and would prescribe certain building and parking standards. All those new standards would go into effect along and near Lincoln Way between Duff and Grand Avenues. Thursday's Tribune also reported the results of a survey that evaluated Iowa State University's living, learning, and working environment. More than 7,000 students, faculty, and staff took part in the survey. Among the findings, 11% of the respondents said they have experienced unwanted sexual contact or conduct while at the university. More than 80% of those who did experience that never reported it to anyone. Overall, nearly 80% of survey respondents said they were comfortable or very comfortable with the university's social climate. Also Thursday in the Trib, a breakdown of how the statewide tax cut the legislature passed last week could affect Story County residents and businesses. Thursday's Trib also had word that an early morning garage fire in Ames on Wednesday caused about $50,000 damage. It took place at 226 South Hazel. No injuries were reported. The Trib also reported that Ames Mayor John Hala and city council members will lead community members on a bike ride from City Hall to Ada Hayden Heritage Park tomorrow morning, Saturday, starting at 9 at City Hall on Clark Avenue, and no registration is needed. It's part of National Bike Month. The mayor and city council members will kick off National Bike to Work Week this coming Monday morning by hosting a free bike commuter continental breakfast from 7 to 9 in front of City Hall. And one more note from Thursday's Trib. A feature story details how a group of Ames High students have spent the past few weeks creating more than a dozen one-of-a-kind portraits for children in need. It's part of an effort called the Memory Project, which invites art teachers and students to create and donate portraits to children in need all around the world. And there you have it, your summary of weekly news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm KHOY Civic Reporter Dennis Hart, wishing you, as always, a happy, safe, and healthy weekend.
Thank you for tuning in to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. That was Dennis Hart providing us with an update on the local news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. It is the second Friday of the month, therefore, Mary Rankin has information on sustainability in the city of Ames.
It's great to be here again. Gosh, it does look like warm weather is here. And with spring comes spring showers, comes a lot of consumption of water. So we want to talk about water today and what we all can do to be more cognizant of sustaining our water, both as individuals and through the community. So with me today is Tracy Warner with the City of Ames, and you're a municipal engineer with the city.
I am.
Hello, Tracy.
Hello,
thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Jake Moore, who's also with the City of Ames, and Jake is a stormwater specialist.
Yes.
It's great to have you here, Jake. Thank you so much. Tell me, guys, about water. Water related to, well, first of all, let's talk about the city. Let's talk about some things that the city is doing to ensure that the water that we have is maintained in a clean and healthy manner. We make use of all the water that comes to us and that we protect our water as much as possible.
Well, the City of Ames Public Works Department has what we call a smart watershed program. And so we are really looking at collaborating with other departments and partners throughout the city on making sure that our water in the rivers and streams are kept clean. That includes, you know, partnering with Smart Trash or partnering with the Water and Pollution Control, also Story County Conservation. Just making sure that those nutrients and trash and pollutants are kept out so we can have the habitat and the clean water.
You know, when we talk about spring showers, of course, that's water that comes to us that we can utilize, but how we utilize and how we're able to keep it in place and then as it runs into nearby streams in our watershed, just as you mentioned, we all have a part to play in ensuring that that water is able to be utilized and clean for our utilization. And there's also a smart water program.
There is a smart water program, and actually smart water and smart watersheds partners on a cost share program for residents to be able to buy a rain barrel and conserve water, capture that rainwater from their downspouts, and then use that water on their lawn or on their flower beds to conserve that water.
Jake, I see that you have information about the Smart Watershed program in front of you.
Well, right now we have five rebate programs or five cost share programs that we have out there right now. Just wanted to touch on why Ames is so involved with the Clean Watershed and Smart Watershed program that we have. Is Ames has quite a few watersheds in it. Of course, we have Ada Hayden on the north side of town, the lake there, which is also a backup for our drinking water. But in addition to that, we have Onion Creek and Clear Creek. We also have College Creek. We have Squaw Creek, which everybody sees when they drive down South Duff. Of course, all of those drain into the South Skunk River. So what the city has come up with is we've come up with our Smart Watershed program. Parts of that, as Tracy mentioned, was the rain barrel cost share. But in addition to that, we have what we call a soil quality restoration or a soil health improvement program. And what that involves is that would be where people aerate their yard. They're trying to get rid of some of that compaction that they have in their soil. And then they would top dress it with topsoil. So we'd like to get some of that organic matter back into the yard. So what we're doing is we're reducing the compaction. We're putting organic matter back into the soil, and then you'd overseed it with your choice of turf.
Part of the rebate program.
That is one of the rebate programs that we have. We also have a program on composters, and we just kicked it off. We kicked it off earlier at the Eco Fair. So it's really going just 2018 was the first year for the compost rebate. We do that with our resource recovery plant as well. It's kind of a multi-use program where we want to reduce wet material that could be going to resource recovery. It doesn't burn well. Public Works promotes it because we'd like to see it go back into the yards because it has a lot of organic matter or organic material where we'd like to put that back into the yard. So it's similar to the program I just spoke about before with the soil health improvements. Composting can be used the same way, but we're not only reducing trash, we're improving soil at the same time.
The things that we put in our garbage related to food is such a rich, amazing fertilizer that we can put back on our yards, put on our gardens, even put in house plants if you're in an apartment. And I think that, gosh, we spend so much money on some of these synthetic items that most definitely aren't as healthy for soil. And also, we're throwing away all these free options. So I am so excited for the composter rebate program. And as you mentioned, directly related to the City of Ames Resource Recovery Center, in doing a waste sort, actually a couple of summers ago, we were looking at what comes in that's actually considered a beneficial fuel to be able to put with the natural gas and provide electricity to the city. And one of the non-beneficial fuels is food waste because, as you mentioned, it doesn't burn. It is landfilled instead. This is a fabulous program to help people kickstart saving those materials from being landfilled and also ensuring that the very beneficial and most beneficial fuels do go to our resource recovery center. So that is fantastic. This is available now. It's online, so people can go out and buy their composters.
It is.
ASAP, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. Okay. All right. So it looks like there's a couple more.
There are. So
wow,
we have
so many options.
Landscaping with native plants cost share program. You could even partner that with the soil health improvement, get your lawn decompacted, and then do a native turf with the native plants. But if you just want to individually plant the deep-rooted native Iowa prairie plants, then you can continue to do that in an area of your lawn that will help to take that root system down. You know, our Kentucky bluegrass lawn mix is about an inch deep on the root system, but these native plants go 5, 6, 10 feet deep, and that helps to absorb that water, get the nutrients from the fertilizers or the pollutants out, and continues to improve our waterways as
right.
well.
And it keeps the soil stable. Right.
Yes. And we also have a rain garden rebate program that if you have an area in your lawn where you could direct some downspouts to, that area could be a depressional area where you plant the native Iowa plants and then that downspout water gets utilized by the plants, infiltrated into the ground. And doing that too, you're recharging our aquifer ultimately as it gets down in through the ground to the groundwater source.
Gosh, these are all such great programs. So timely. Because we're getting out in our yards, we're making those plans, we're starting to make those purchases, and in fact, major plant sale at Ryman Gardens actually this weekend coming up to get a number of those native species that we're talking about and start that planting. So any other information about the rebates and where should they go? Where should our listeners go for more information?
They can go to the City of Ames website and they can search Smart Watersheds.
Okay.
It's also under the Public Works page. Check under Stormwater. You'll will take you to our Smart Watersheds page, and all those rebate programs are listed, along with a lot of other additional information.
That's great. Excellent. Okay, so let's talk about some things the city is doing related to water quality. I know there's this thing going on in the parking lot over by City Hall. You guys want to talk a little bit more about that?
The City of Ames, we looked at needing to replace the parking lot on the west side of City Hall. We obtained grants to redo the parking lot pavement with what is considered a permeable paver system.
Mm-hmm.
There are thick rock layers, and I'll let Jake get into some of the details as well, but it's a stormwater system that holds back what is considered even the 100-year flood event. So we have water quality features and flood control all within this parking lot that we've reconstructed.
Tell us more about these features, Jake.
So as Tracy mentioned, it was an existing parking lot,
yes,
and it was 30 to 35 years old, and so it did need to be replaced. It's a good opportunity for us to make improvements, not only to the parking lot itself, but also reduce runoff rates,
right,
and to help clean the water as it's discharged. So we call that water quality.
That's fabulous. Yes, because prior to the replacement of this parking lot, there was no water retained on site. Fair
correct
to say?
Correct.
Fair to say, yeah.
Yeah, yes. Okay.
It all went straight into the storm sewer that goes through the parking lot and went straight past between the Hy-Vee and DOT area and straight into Squaw Creek.
And took all the fluids and all the stuff that it might have picked up along the way right with it, right?
Yes.
Yes.
All
okay
flowed right
but
to the
not
creek
anymore.
Yes.
Right. So some of the project goals with the project, of course, we wanted to slow down the rate of runoff, and we wanted to slow that all the way down to meadow grasses in good condition with what we call a type B soil, which would just be a rich, fertile soil.
Sure. Right.
So we wanted to treat the water quality on site as well, which would be the first inch and a quarter that falls on the site. That typically carries what we call the first flush,
right,
where we want to grab those oils or those that break dust, any contaminants.
Exactly.
Which kind of leads me into biocells on site. So Tracy mentioned the permeable pavers, but on site we also have biocells. What the biocells are is it's a type of detention where water can drain to that area and it will contain it and slow it down, and it's majority of the soil in the bioretention cell is the sand.
Okay.
And then we plant those with native plants, and what that does is it allows water to soak back into the ground and helps recharge the ground, and any water that does need to discharge off site because the ground can't take it, it slows it down and reduces the rate while it cleanses it all at the same time.
I was going
time
to say the yeah sand has that filtration
right
ability for cleaning and increased quality, correct?
It does. Yeah, it yeah does. In fact, you can put in just straight up sand filters. It's a very common practice
mm-hmm
for treating water quality. We went with the bioretention cells so that there's organic matter on the top layer and then native plants are planted within that. Visually, you have that great native plant aesthetic that people visiting City Hall can see.
Also wanted to mention a little bit about the parts of the project that you don't see necessarily when you
okay
go out and look at it. Underneath the pavers, we have a lot of rock, and we have different types of rock, different sizes, typically the same type of rock, mostly limestone, but different sizes. So we have, on the very bottom, what we call our storage, where it'd be a larger, 4 to 5 inch stone, and that's where you put the majority of the water to keep it on site.
Mm-hmm.
Above that, you have a smaller stone, but the larger stone may be anywhere from 21 inches in depth all the way to 8 inches in depth.
Okay.
And then we have a little bit smaller, like a 1 inch stone on top of that. And then in order to lay the pavers, they had to put a smaller chip so that they could get a nice even grade to lay
of
the
course
pavers on. So there's a lot of underground detention, which you don't necessarily, you're not aware of unless
mm-hmm
you see, a sketch that we have or something like that. But there's a lot of storage underneath the ground.
That's fantastic. So many things happening in this parking lot. And if we think about it, gosh, there's so many spaces that we park on across our community. It's space that you can still utilize for what you need to. It's not going to interrupt what the intended use is at all and do so much good for our watershed. That's fantastic. Anything else you think our viewers should know about? I know they will be seeing those beautiful native species in the parking lot, depending upon the weather, later this month. Is that
yeah
correct?
Later this month, we'll finish up the what we call the eco turf, which is buffalo grass and blue grama grass. It's a mixture. We'll seed those in May. We'll finish seeding the site, and then it'll take a couple months to get that going. But they are warm season grasses, so typically seed those when the temperatures are a little bit warmer than you would a cool season grass, early in the spring. So I also wanted to mention with the native plants that are on site, we had a really neat project with the high school.
Oh,
and
great.
The high school students grew some of the native plants that were planted on site at the greenhouse at the high school. His students came out and they helped plant as well, which was
a
great help. It was an interesting day trying to keep everybody organized and make sure the correct plants got planted in the right spot. So we did a lot of marking and preparation ahead of time, but we're really excited to see those plants take off
I also want to mention two other partners that we had on this project, being the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, as well as the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. So we were able to receive water quality funding through both of those organizations to help with this project to be as a statewide demonstration of how parking lots can be redone, and even with the bioretention cells and native turf, and be different than the standard parking lot. Yeah, the city of Ames was recognized recently at the Iowa Water Conference. We were awarded a plaque that recognized us as a leading jurisdiction for green infrastructure.
Congratulations. For those listeners who receive the Iowa Department of Natural Resources monthly magazine, Iowa Outdoors, there's a lovely article in it about this particular project. Gosh, what a great discussion about water. So many things to discuss, so many opportunities that we all have to ensure that we keep our water quality at the very best that it can be, and we're the very best citizens toward stewardship with our water in our community. So, Tracy, thank you very much. Jake, thank you as well. Any other parting comments or websites that our folks should check out for any more information?
I would say if you're out there cleaning in the yard, consider getting a composter using our new cost share program. That'll be a great way to turn that, either the leaves or the lawn clippings in your food, into that nice organic matter to get a healthier lawn.
Well, thank you again, both for joining me. And again, information can be found on the City of Ames website. You can look for Smart Watershed Program and all the rebates that we have discussed today, as well as information about that amazing parking lot right there at City Hall. Have a great day, everyone.
We've been speaking with Mary Rankin, Sustainability Director for Iowa State and the City of Ames, about water in our community. More information is available on the City of Ames website if you search for Smart Watersheds, the Smart Water Program, or the rebates discussed in the program. We'll also put a link to it on our website, khoifm.org. You have been listening to Local Talk. I am Saquon Gatlin. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment. KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.